I'd like to welcome everyone here this morning to the Second Court of Appeals. Before we begin, I'd like to introduce the panel. To my left is Judge Wallach, who is sitting by assignment as a visiting judge. To my right is Justice Lee Gabriel, and I'm Justice Bonnie Sutter, the Chief Justice of the Court. It's my understanding that the attorneys have signed in for the 9 o'clock argument. We have two arguments today, a 9 o'clock and a 10:30 argument, but it's my understanding the attorneys are all here and signed in. And if the clerk would please call the case.
The court will now call Friedman and Fiber LLP versus Robert E. Massey. And may it please the court, Mr. David Kelman to argue for the appellant, Mr. Scott Work to argue for the appellant.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, together with Joe Greenhill and Marla Broadus, I'm proud to represent the law firm. This is an arbitration case, as you know. Even though it's undisputed that the party's contingent fee agreement contained a very broad arbitration clause, the trial court not only denied arbitration but prohibited it. In doing so, she ran afoul of no less than 4 Texas Supreme Court cases and 2 cases from this court. The facts in this case are largely undisputed, with one exception which I'll explain that has nothing to do with arbitration. Facts are clear, and this is something that I think is important. Massey, with the advice of independent counsel, solicited the law firm. This is not one where the law firm sought employment. Massey went to the law firm to get it and suggested a contingent fee agreement. It's undisputed that in that conversation, Mr. Friedman was told that there was an existing 40% contract that had been approved by the court, and his contract would replace that. On that basis, he undertook the representation. The law firm agreed, pursued the case, and eventually it settled. At settlement, one important thing happened. Massey and the law firm entered into a written settlement and release. In that, Mr. Massey was again represented by independent counsel, so he wasn't dealing just with Mr. Friedman. In that release, there was an agreement to reduce the contingent fee from 40% to a third, and then additionally, the law firm was released from any liability relating to its representation or under the contingent fee agreement. Note that this lawsuit that we think ought to be arbitrated involves the contingent fee agreement. At the same time, they agreed that the representation on the contingent fee had terminated as of January 10th, 2014.
Is that agreement in writing somewhere?
Yes, it is, and it's in the record at page 67 through 69. The important thing is the contingent fee agreement itself has a broad arbitration clause. It's any dispute concerning any aspect of the firm's representation or any claim or construction of the contingent fee agreement, whether sounding in contract or tort, and additionally, it was to be determined by JAMS in Dallas. After everything finished, and this is the disputed fact, the law firm was asked to defend against third-party claims. In other words, not trying to get a contingent fee recovery against EECU, but to represent third-party claims that were for debts actually incurred long before. And by the way, Mr. Massey disagrees. He said there was no retention, but he certainly accepted the representation. When those fees went unpaid, the law firm sued, and sued where the probate case was pending, where they had to do it. And they sued in that court almost 3 years later. For the first time, although there noise had been made about the validity of the contingent fee agreement, the first counterclaim was filed for the first time seeking affirmative relief based on the alleged voidness of the contingent fee agreement. That's the first time it happened. 30 days later, we file a motion to compel and a request for arbitration, and that's what got us here. This court knows, because the court has handled a number of arbitration claims, knows that the burden shifts once a arbitration agreement is produced that is broad. And the question then is, what defenses are raised? In the response to the motion to compel, only two are raised, waiver and unconscionability. I'm not going to discuss conscionability and rely on the brief, because in the briefing before the court, Mr. Massey does not raise any arguments on that. It only deals with waiver and void ab initio, which we'll also talk about. The decision of the trial court, though, was undoubtedly on waiver. And don't take my word for it. Look at page 51, which is the end of the motion to compel proceedings in the county court in Parker County. The court points to a March 17, 2015 letter, which is not in the record. It was evidently attached to a summary judgment issue, and she says, you all, and she asked this question, I assume you all knew from that far back that Mr. Massey had some issues with your services. After hearing the answer of, yeah, he did say that, but the first time he claimed it was 30 days ago, she rules. Obviously, the ruling is on waiver. And let's talk about waiver. The Supreme Court has gone into great detail on waiver over the years, and as the Supreme Court puts it in the Richmond Holdings case in 2014, findings of waiver are exceedingly rare. And they are because of the presumptions. First, the presumption in favor of arbitration. Second, the presumption against waiver, as the Supreme Court held in RSL in 2016. And all doubts are decided in favor of arbitration. That's also Richmond Holdings, additionally, Perry Holmes and the like. So in waiver, what do you have to prove? Well, there are two elements. One is that the movement substantially invoked the judicial process, and second, that as a result of that, there was some prejudice to the other side. The Supreme Court cases, especially RSL and Perry Holmes was in 2008, RSL in 2016, had came up with the same factors, and I'm going to go through them with you. But the most important factor is this. When considering these things, the court must consider the arbitrable claims, not other claims that might be unarbitrable.
So let me ask you this. In your claimant's original demand for arbitration, you have several counts in there that relate to the non-payment that you filed your breach of contract claim about for the third-party claims, the representation in that. If that wasn't, how's that not waiver, that you filed those claims for arbitration?
There's no case that ever finds that a claim filed for arbitration is waiver, number one. But number two, let me answer the question because you raise an interesting point that is important. If you look at the motion to compel, it is only, which is filed in the trial court, which we are reviewing now, it is only on the contingent fee agreement on the counterclaim brought by Mr. Massey.
But this demand is in the record.
Demand for arbitration, though, you are exactly right, Judge, is different from that. And here's the reason for it. I wish it wasn't in the record, but it is. There's no doubt that we move on both things. If you look, you'll see in paragraphs 7 and 8 and counts 5 and 6, the contingent fee is in as well. The reason we included the others is because Mr. Massey kept telling the court that everything was related, that the hourly fees were related to the contingent fee, to make sure we had everything up in front of the arbitrator in jams. We took that step. Now, let me confess to you, I think it is clear, only the contingent fee agreement has the arbitration clause. So the only appropriate arbitration could be over the contingent fee. It could not be over the hourly fee. And again, I must admit that.
But you started out the lawsuit with just the contract.
Yes.
Claim, and they brought in the contingency.
That's precisely.
So until they brought in the counterclaim that dealt with the contingency contract, you had no reason to believe that any of that would be arbitratable because what you sued under originally wouldn't have an arbitration
clause.
That's
precisely right, Your Honor. And I'm sure Mr. Bork will point this out. One of the things happened is they did talk about the contingent fee agreement and it potentially being void, but they never made an affirmative claim for it. And of course, arbitration is based on affirmative claims, not what could be. And that's very important. And this court has reviewed that kind of thing relatively recently.
That was in their pleading, though, that it was void.
It was in their pleading that it was devoid. It wasn't even as a defensive issue, though, if you look at it, and there was certainly no claim for affirmative relief based on that. When they amended in the original counterclaim and had the first claim for affirmative relief is when we moved for arbitration, and appropriately so, 30 days later. And under the RSL Perry Holmes factors, that's what you look at, is what is arbitrable. And how long it was, whether there was discovery. And let's talk about that, because their brief concentrates on it. They say there was some discovery. There was. We sent a request for 194 request for disclosure with our answer. That is it. We sought no other discovery. And that was on the unarbitratable claim on the hourly fee. It wasn't on the other. So that was, those were those issues. Now, their main discussion, and if you look at their brief, you'll see, is Perry Holmes versus Cull. As you know, that originated in this court. The Supreme Court actually affirmed this court in finding waiver. Far different case. There was a denial of arbitrability first up by the plaintiff in 79-page vehement statement about the AAA's crooked and all those kinds of things. Huge amounts of discovery, 10 deposition, 5 motions to compel, substantial requests, repeated requests for productions, motions for sanctions, those types of things. And the Supreme Court, in fact, as Justice Brister, who wrote the opinion, said, we've never seen anything like this in a waiver case. Of course this is waiver, because after everything had been completed, the discovery window closed, so they got all the discovery they could get. Then they moved for arbitration, and the court said, no, you can't change horses like that. The real truth of the matter, it caused prejudice in this case because you robbed them of any, robbed Perry Holmes of any opportunity for appellate review relating to the discovery, motion to compel, and sanctions issues. Now, Perry Holmes is nothing like our case. In our case, 30 days after they filed their claim, we moved to arbitrate. That's number one. Number two, equally is important. We never sought a resolution of the merits of the case, which the Supreme Court continually says is the important matter. We did defend against their motion for summary judgment, but as the Supreme Court said, or with the Eastern Court of Appeals, Terry McCall said in the Landwehr case in 2006, that doesn't do it, and referred to the RSL case as well in doing that. So it's not like us at all. Now, what they do is an interesting sleight of hand, and it's clever, but it won't work. What they say is, well, in answer to your question, all these claims are related. The hourly fee and the contingent fee are inherently related, and therefore this is like Perry Holmes. Well, it doesn't have the discovery, doesn't have the kinds of things that went on, no denial of arbitration, none of that. So I disagree legally, but factually the reason they do it, they say, well, in the original petition, and by the way, this is true, I have to confess, in the original petition, we included $5,000 that was not appropriate for the hourly claim. It involved the finalization of the EECU contingent fee settlement. We amended, called that attention to the court, did so in an open hearing, and then also did in an amended pleading taking that out. So they're not mixed. I mean, after all, look at it this way. The contingent fee was $245,000. It's collected, long since been paid. The hourly fee claim was $41,000. This case on waiver is almost exactly the same as Landwehr. Again, the Eastland Court of Appeals opinion. There, the case went on for 3 years. Minimal discovery, but much more than there is here. And that discovery, basically, they had requests for production and other things, and the court said there was no waiver there. Now, let me talk about void ab initio. It does not get them anywhere, and here's the reason. The Texas Supreme Court, both in Perry Holmes, at page 589, and Labatt Food Services, decided in 2009 by Justice Johnson, both hold this, that if the claim is that the entire agreement is void because of violation of a statute, in that case, in Labatt, it was a labor code violation, then that is a question for the arbitrator to decide, not for a court to decide. Following the Buckeye check cashing case from Justice Scalia on the United States Supreme Court. And Texas is in line with virtually every state in the union with those holdings. So even if their claim is right, it doesn't work. It isn't right either, because one, that's not the reason that the court ruled. Second, remember, Mr. Massey signed this contingent fee agreement individually. He would not be included by the estate's code. Third, the release and settlement agreement released the law firm from liability under the contingent fee agreement in any event, and the fee had been reformed to a third. The final thing, and I may not get all the way to this, is the issue that Justice Gabriel brought up about the claims being subject to arbitration. I ask you, if you will, to look at paragraphs 7 and 8 of the demand with JAMS and with claims 5 and 6, and you'll see that the contingent fee agreement was raised in that arbitration as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please, court. So, the law is clear that a party that moves to compel arbitration must first establish the existence of an agreement, of an arbitration agreement. The fatal flaw for their appeal is that they have failed and did not establish the existence of a contract, and therefore not an arbitration agreement either.
Why is that issue not to be decided by the arbitrator?
That's a good question, Your Honor. They don't address the void ab initio argument, only to accept us to say that arbitrability is for the arbitrator. However, this objection that they've made is not before this court, because that was never raised in the trial court, was never raised in any hearing before Judge Johnson. And so the court here cannot and really should not even consider that objection, because in our opinion it's been waived. The very first time that objection was raised was March 4th, 2019 in their reply brief. But even if the court considers the objection, it fails because there is no evidence in the record that establishes what they're required to establish, and that is clear and unmistakable evidence that the parties agreed to arbitrate arbitrability. The cases they cite all talk about adopting rules of the AAA or JAMS or some arbitration organization rules. However, the problem they have is that the rules of JAMS are not in evidence before this court. They are not in the record. They're not part of the record. And so without those rules in the record, they cannot be considered. The first time those rules appear in any kind of hearing, any kind of proceeding in this matter, is in their reply brief. Never before then. So there's no clear and unmistakable evidence that the parties agreed to arbitrate arbitrability. It's interesting.
Could we not take judicial notice of those rules?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Could we not take judicial notice of those rules?
I don't think the court can take judicial notice of an organization's rules. It's not a statute. It's not common law. It's an organization outside of our regular statutory rules and common law. So I don't believe the court could take judicial notice of that. This is a contract that's drafted by Friedman and Feiger, and it was given to Mr. Massey to sign. The rules are not attached to the agreement itself either. And again, they're not in the record. So we believe that the record is devoid of any of this clear and unmistakable evidence that the parties agreed to give the issue of arbitrability to the arbitrator. We do believe that the contract is void, though. It's important to note that the issue of void ab initio, we believe, is before the court. It's littered all throughout the record in this case. Specifically, you can find it in Volume 2 of the reporter's record, pages 14 to 17. More specifically, page 16, line 5, to page 17, line 16. This has been a known issue, and the objection has been made for a long time. They knew of this argument since August 24th, 2015. He raised the issue of Judge Johnson asking him about a letter, asking him about a letter from May of 2015 that raised this issue. So they can't argue that they don't know about this issue. Additionally, there are no findings of facts or conclusions of law requested by the appellant here. And where findings of facts and conclusions of law are not properly requested, none are filed, the judgment of the trial court must be affirmed if it can be upheld on any legal theory. So we believe the void ab initio issue is before the court, and the evidence in the record supports a finding of this legal theory. So the alleged agreement before this court is a 40% contingent fee agreement that required court approval, and they never got court approval. Now, the word required is important because it's straight out of the statute. 351.152A of the estate code limits contingent fee contracts to 33 1/3%. But 351.152B of the law is really clear, and it's unambiguous. It said the court must approve a contract entered into or a conveyance made under this section before an attorney performs any legal services. So a contract entered into or a conveyance made in violation of this section is void unless the court ratifies or reforms the contract. So this is a 40% fee contract. The record's clear on that regard. The record is also clear that Friedman and Feiger never sought court ratification. They never sought reformation. And so the record is totally devoid of any such order from any court. They do say that the subsequent agreement that reduced the fee from 40% to 33 1/3 is so low that a court's not required to approve it, but they're wrong in that regard for two reasons. One, they don't interpret the statute properly. This is an agreement made after the case had already gone on for a long time, and it was after settlement. It was done after the case was settled. The agreement to reduce, interestingly enough, had nothing to do with trying to bring their agreement into compliance with the statute, but really had everything to do with trying to negotiate their own fees and convince a client to settle. So the agreement to reduce does not relieve them from application of the statute. Their contract was never approved before they began the work. Even if their position were true, they have admitted that at least one portion, and this was talked about earlier, at least one portion of the hourly fee alleged agreement added to the situation, again, takes the fee, the contingent fee portion, over the 33 1/3%. An action which, by their own admission, indeed is related to the alleged contingent fee contract.
But once they amended their pleadings and withdrew that, why is that still a problem?
Well, it's a problem because they didn't do that until 2018, in November of 2018, or maybe September of 2018. So for 3 years, they had this issue where this amount of money was above and beyond the 33 1/3%. And so their argument that these claims are not related and that this was never related to the contingent fee agreement, they fail because it goes back to the very beginning. They spent more than 3 years chasing that amount with the rest of the hourly fees. So we believe it's all related.
I have a problem conceptually here. Okay. You want us to look at the contingency fee contract to get relief from the breach of contract action, and yet you want us to disregard the contingency fee contract for the purposes of avoiding arbitration. And it seems to me you kind of want to have it both ways, and I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around the equity of that position.
We don't, it's not our argument that the contingent fee agreement gets us out of the breach of contract action. It's our argument that the breach of the contract action is related to the contingent fee agreement, but
and that everything's been paid.
The under the contingent fee agreement, except for the $5,000 that they alleged, that's not been paid. But we have different defenses to the breach of contract action that we do to the contingent fee agreement. The contingent fee agreement is one thing. He mentioned that it's undisputed that Mr. Massey accepted or approved or requested the hourly fee work, and that is actually hotly disputed.
He actually said that was disputed.
Yes.
That is what he said. Okay.
Yes. Yes. Did that answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes.
Essentially, the arbitration issue, we believe, is one that's easy to address for several reasons. One, because the contract, the fee agreement, is void. Two, because of the waiver issues, which we address in the record and also in our brief. I would state to the court that the Perry factors, one of the phrases that has not been mentioned here is the phrase totality of the circumstances. And there are several factors from Perry Holmes that the court lays out. One of the main factors, though, is that you look at a party's actions in the totality of the circumstances. And when you look at the totality of the circumstances here, the court mentions the phrase, whether or not a party's activities are inconsistent with an intent to arbitrate. And since 2015, until they started getting a little bit more pushback than they had in 2018, they did not act with an activity consistent with an intent to arbitrate.
But isn't that always the case when you've got this particular issue? The lawsuit gets filed, and that's inconsistent.
Correct.
So that's a given in any of these disputes, that you can have, at a minimum, that much of inconsistency. It has to be more than that, right?
Correct.
So what more is out there?
I believe there's more. First of all, we do believe that they have substantially invoked the litigation process. They were the ones to file in the court. They waited more than 3 years to seek arbitration. Whether they knew of the arbitration clause all along, they drafted this contract.
But what happened in those 3 years?
Well, admittedly, there wasn't much pretrial activity. And in hindsight, perhaps I should have filed a motion to dismiss for want of prosecution rather than contest their motion to compel arbitration. I do believe that this case probably, their case probably should have been dismissed for want of prosecution. But that doesn't excuse the fact that the Massey parties had to deal with this for more than 3 years before being faced with a motion to compel arbitration. There wasn't much discovery done in this case, but the discovery done in this case did lay out the defenses that the Massey parties intended to pursue, namely one of them being that the contingent fee contract was void.
But they actually filed their request for arbitration within 30 days of you filing your counterclaim, which raised the contingency fee contract for the first time in a pleading. Other than their request for $5,000, correct?
I do believe in the original answer there was, and I'm speaking out of belief. I'm not 100% certain, but I do believe in the original answer, the issue was raised about the voidability of the contract. I could be wrong about that, just for the record. But I do believe that this has been raised from the very beginning. So on that issue, one of the major factors here in what's happened, and I see my time is almost up, so one last thing I want to talk about, is with the discovery, it's interesting because their position here is inconsistent with their own language in their contract. They want to say that the JAMS rules allow for discovery, and that was one of the issues raised in the record at the hearing on the motion to compel. The streamlined rules from JAMS, which again I don't believe are before this court, but they evidently allow for some limited discovery. But they're the ones that refer to the JAMS rules in their contract that they presented. But the contract itself says no discovery, which, in my opinion, is even further evidence that there is no clear and unmistakable evidence that the parties intended for those JAMS rules to apply, because it's clear that even Friedman and Feiger doesn't know the full extent of those rules. And they're the ones that drafted the contract. So the one other big issue that I'll mention real quickly is that all of their claims that they put in the claims for demand for arbitration that are not related to the contingent fee agreement, and they're the ones that moved this stuff over, we believe are now moot, as the court, Judge Johnson has ruled that those claims are time barred by statute of limitations. They say that they moved our counterclaims, but I disagree with that. I've looked through the pleadings, and I don't agree that they've moved our counterclaims over there. And in that regard, I do believe that, and I've looked for case law to substantiate this. I haven't found any. This is my first experience with this kind of a case and moving a claim from the trial court to arbitration. But I liken it to a federal system. When a case is removed from state court to a federal court, the plaintiff's petition is moved. And that's part of the process. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, let me start with a clarification of Justice Gabriel to your question about the claim for affirmative relief for the first time in the original counterclaim. And that was the first time affirmative relief was sought on the void ab initio. Mr. Ward is right. They did mention the void ab initio in their original answer, but they did not tie it to any claim for affirmative relief. Of course, we couldn't arbitrate something that isn't raised in the pleadings, and that's why we didn't do it. He starts the argument by saying that we did not raise that it was not an arbitratable issue in the trial court. That belies the problem that in his response to our motion to arbitrate, he raises only two defenses. And it's clear, and that you can see it at page 216 through 222 of the argument, it was just waiver and unconscionability. He also says we never raised it to our reply brief. That's wrong. If you look at footnote 22 on page 26 of our original brief, we worried that he might make a point of that, and as a result, we raised it up front.
What about the point that he made that there's no evidence that the parties agreed to arbitrate
arbitrability.
How do you say that?
Well, the fact is he does that two ways. He says that, well, that is, the JAMS rules aren't in the record. Look at Dow Roofing, this court's case from last year. In Dow Roofing, same thing. The court took judicial notice of the AAA rules that weren't in the evidence. The same thing is appropriate here. And I don't think that is any problem whatsoever.
So you agree that there's no evidence in the record, but you think we can take judicial notice of it?
Well, actually, he discussed the JAMS rules in some detail with the judge at the trial court without introducing the JAMS rules. So the judge certainly heard a lot about the JAMS rules in the at the deal. And that was his point, that it was discovery versus no discovery. He also raises the finding of fact and conclusions of law, Justice Gabriel, as you know, as you pointed out in Legoland in a footnote, there's a big question whether findings of fact and conclusions of law would be appropriate in a motion to compel arbitration. But it doesn't really make any difference in any event in this case, because it is clear, one, why the judge ruled, and even on the merits of the claim, we win it in any event. Void, he's saying the whole contract is void. The Texas Supreme Court, which faced the same issue as the court here faced in Perry Homes and more in In re Labatt, which is on all fours with us, made exactly the same argument and said, interesting argument, that is long been held by the United States Supreme Court in our court under Perry Homes, to be a question for the arbitrator. So that's, I think, clear. The question was asked that wasn't completely answered, and that was, what happened in the trial court since it filed? As he says, virtually nothing. Nothing on our behalf except responding to their attempts to get rid of the case. Now, he also says, well, now everything is mooted since the trial court ruled. A little misleading and demonstrates the danger of what the trial court did. We moved for a motion to stay. The judge said she would hear it. And she carried it on two occasions, and then instead of ruling on it, to our surprise, off base, not in open court, ruled on the summary judgment motion instead, leaving the motion to stay undecided, knowing that this court had the case was before it. But in any event, does that ruling moot anything? No. Here's how I can tell you. In re Zachary Scott, a Sam Day opinion from 2003 from this court, undoes retroactively trial court rulings, and that on discovery and a motion to compel, if the arbitration was determined not had to have been wrongfully denied. So I don't think there can be any moot on this at all. Final thing, there can be no dispute that there was difference between the contingent fee agreement on one hand and the claim for hourly fees for two reasons. First off, in their response to the motion for summary judgment, they say precisely that. I say response. In their motion for partial summary judgment, they draw that dichotomy themselves and tell the court that there is no relationship between the two. Second issue, and equally as important, the contingent fee was $245,000. Our request for hourly fees was $41,000. They were obviously not related. And I think my light's gone off. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Gentlemen, we appreciate your argument today. It's been very helpful to us. You're now free. Your case has been submitted. You're now free to go about your business. Thank you.
All rise.